I raise the glass of water. It looks perfectly real, right down to the way it sweats and the cold wetness of it on my fingertips. I look into Amanda's eyes. I examine the walls. They're not melting. If this is some drug-induced trip, it's like none I've ever heard of. No visual or auditory distortions, no euphoria. It's not that this place doesn't feel real. I just shouldn't be here. It's somehow my presence that's the lie. I'm not even exactly sure what that means, only that I feel it in my core. No, this is not a hallucination. This is something else entirely. Let's try a different approach, Amanda says. What's the last thing you remember before waking up in the hangar? I was at a bar. What were you doing there? Seeing an old friend. And where was this bar? She asks. Logan Square. So you were still in Chicago? Yeah. Okay, can you describe? Her voice drops off into silence. I see the L. It's dark. It's quiet. Too quiet for Chicago. Someone is coming. Someone who wants to hurt me. My heart begins to race. My hands sweat. I set the glass down on the table. Jason, Layton is telling me your vitals are becoming elevated. Her voice is back, but still an ocean away. Is this a trick? Am I being messed with? No, do not ask her that. Do not say those words. Be the man they think you are. These people are cool, calm, and two of them are armed. Whatever they need to hear you say, say it. Because if they realize you aren't the person they think you are, then what? Then maybe you never leave this place. My head is beginning to throb. Reaching up, I touch the back of my skull and graze a knot that's so tender it causes me to wince. Jason? Was I hurt? Did someone attack me? What if I was brought here? What if these people, despite how nice they seem, are in league with the person who did this to me? I touch the side of my head. Feel the damage from a second blow. Jason. I see a geisha mask. I'm naked and helpless. Jason. Just a few hours ago, I was home, cooking dinner. I am not the man they think I am. What happens when they figure that out? Layton, could you come down, please? Nothing good. I need to not be in this room anymore. I need to get away from these people. I need to think. Amanda. I drag myself back into the moment, try to drive the questions and the fear out of my mind, but it's like shoring up a failing levee. It won't last. It won't hold. This is embarrassing, I say. I'm just so exhausted, and to be honest, decontamination was no fun. Do you want to break for a minute? Would that be okay? I just need a moment to clear my head. I point at the laptop. I also want to sound mildly intelligent for this thing. Of course. She types something. We're off the record now. I get up. She says, I can show you to a private room. Not necessary. I open the door and step out into the corridor. Layton Vance is waiting. Jason, I'd like you to lie down. Your vitals are headed in the wrong direction. I rip the device off my arm and hand it to the doctor. Appreciate the concern, but what I really need is a bathroom stall. Oh, of course. I'll take you. We head down the corridor. Digging his shoulder into the heavy glass door, he leads me back into the stairwell, which at the moment is empty. No sound but the ventilation system pumping heated air through a nearby vent. I grasp the railing and lean out over the core of open space. Two flights to the bottom, two to the top. What did Amanda say at the start of the interview? That we're on sub-level 2? Does that mean this is all underground? Jason, you coming? I follow Layton, climbing, fighting through the weakness in my legs, the pain in my head. At the top of the stairwell, a sign beside a reinforced steel door reads, Ground. Layton swipes a keycard, punches in a code, and holds the door open. The words, Velocity Laboratories, are affixed in block letters across the wall straight ahead. Left, a bank of elevators. Right, a security checkpoint, with a hard-looking guard standing between the metal detector and the turnstile, the exit just beyond. It seems like the security here is outward-facing, focused more on preventing people from getting in than getting out. Layton directs me past the elevators and down a hallway to a pair of double doors at the far end, which he opens with his keycard. As we enter, he hits the lights, revealing a well-appointed office, the walls adorned in aviation photographs of commercial airliners and military supersonic jets and the engines that power them. A framed photo on the desk draws my focus, an older man holding a boy in his arms that looks very much like Layton. They're standing in a hangar, in front of a massive turbofan in the midst of assembly.
"I thought you'd be more comfortable in my private bathroom."
Layton points toward a door in the far corner.
"I'll be right here," he says,
sitting down on the edge of his desk and pulling a phone out of his pocket.
"Shout if you need anything."
The bathroom is cold and immaculate. There's a toilet, a urinal, a walk-in shower, and a small window halfway up the back wall. I take a seat on the toilet. My chest feels so tight I can barely breathe. They've been waiting for me to return for 14 months. There's no way they're letting me walk out of this building. Not tonight. Maybe not for a long time, considering I'm not the man they think they're talking to. Unless this is all some elaborate test or game. Layton's voice pushes through the door.
"Everything all right in there?"
"Yeah."
"I don't know what you saw inside that thing, but I want you to know I'm here for you, brother. If you're freaking out, you got to tell me so I can help you."
I rise. He continues,
"I was watching you from the theater, and I have to say, you looked out of it."
If I were to walk back into the lobby with him, could I break away, make a dash through security? I picture that massive guard standing by the metal detector. Probably not.
"Physically, I think you're going to be fine, but I worry about your psychological state."
I have to step onto the lip of the porcelain urinal to reach the window. The glass appears to be locked shut by means of a lever on each side. It's only 2 feet by 2 feet, and I'm not sure if I can fit through. Layton's voice echoes through the bathroom, and as I creep back toward the sink, his words become clear again.
"Worst thing you can do is try to manage this on your own. Let's be honest, you're the kind of guy who thinks he's strong enough to push through anything."
I approach the door. There's a deadbolt. With trembling fingers, I slowly turn the lock cylinder.
"But no matter what you're feeling," his voice, close now, inches away, "I want you to share it with me. And if we need to push this debriefing until tomorrow or the next—"
He goes silent as the bolt shoots home with a soft click. For a moment, nothing happens. I take a careful step back. The door moves imperceptibly and then rattles ferociously inside its frame. Layton says,
"Jason! Jason!"
And then,
"I need a security team to my office right now. Dessen has locked himself inside the bathroom."
The door shutters as Layton crashes into it, but the lock holds. I rush for the window, climb up onto the urinal, and flip the levers on either side of the glass. Layton is shouting at someone, and although I can't make out the words, I think I hear approaching footsteps. The window opens. Night air funnels in. Even standing on the urinal, I'm not sure if I can make it up there. Leaping off the edge, I hurl myself toward the open frame, but only manage to get one arm through. As something bangs into the bathroom door, my shoes scrape across the smooth vertical surface of the wall. There's no traction or purchase to be had. I drop to the floor, climb back up onto the urinal. Layton screams at someone, "Come on!" I jump again, and this time, I manage to land both arms across the windowsill. It isn't much of a hold, but it's just enough to keep me from falling. I wriggle through as the bathroom door breaks down behind me. Layton yells my name. I tumble for a half second through darkness.
crash face first into pavement. Up on my feet, stunned, dazed, ears ringing, blood running down the side of my face. I'm outside in a dark alley between two buildings. Layton appears in the open window frame above me.
Jason, don't do this! Let me help you!
I turn and run, no idea where I'm going, just blazing toward the opening at the end of the alley. I reach it, launch down a set of brick steps. I'm in an office park. Bland, low-rise buildings cluster around a sad little pond with a lighted fountain in the middle. Considering the hour, it's no surprise there's no one out. I fly past benches, trimmed shrubbery, a gazebo, a sign with an arrow under the words, "To Walking Path." A quick glance over my shoulder. The building I just escaped is a five-story, nondescript, utterly forgettable piece of architectural mediocrity, and people are streaming out of the entrance like a kicked hornet's nest. At the end of the pond, I leave the sidewalk and follow a gravel footpath. Sweat stings my eyes, my lungs are on fire, but I keep pumping my arms and throwing one foot in front of the other. With each stride, the lights from the office park fall farther and farther away. Straight ahead, there's nothing but welcoming darkness, and I'm moving toward it, into it, like my life depends upon it. A strong, reviving wind slams into my face, and I'm starting to wonder where I'm going, because shouldn't there be some light in the distance, like even a speck of it? But I'm running into an immense chasm of black. I hear waves. I arrive on a beach. There's no moon, but the stars are vivid enough to suggest the roiling surface of Lake Michigan. I look inland toward the office park, catch incoming wind-cut voices, and glimpse several flashlight beams slashing through the dark. Turning north, I begin to run, my shoes crunching wave-polished rocks. Miles up the shoreline, I can see the indistinct nighttime glow of downtown, where the skyscrapers edge up against the water. I look back, see some lights heading south, away from me, others heading north, gaining on me. I veer away from the water's edge, cross a bike path, and aim for a row of bushes. The voices are closer. I wonder if it's dark enough for me to stay unseen. A 3-foot seawall stands in my path, and I scale the concrete, barking my shins on the way over and staying on all fours as I crawl through the hedgerow. Branches grabbing my shirt and face, clawing at my eyes. Out of the bushes, I stumble into the middle of a road that parallels the lakeshore. From the direction of the office park, I hear an engine revving. High beams blind me. I cross the road, hop a chain-link fence, and suddenly I'm running through someone's yard, dodging overturned bicycles and skateboards, then darting alongside the house while a dog goes apoplectic inside. Lights popping on as I hit the backyard, jump the fence again, and find myself sprinting across an empty baseball outfield, wondering how much longer I can keep this up. The answer comes with remarkable speed. On the edge of the infield, I collapse, sweat pouring off my body, every muscle in agony. That dog is still barking in the distance, but looking back toward the lake, I see no flashlights, hear no voices. I lie there I don't know how long, and it seems as if hours pass before I can take a breath without gasping. I finally manage to sit up. The night is cool, and the breeze coming off the lake pushes through the surrounding trees, sending a storm of autumn leaves down on the diamond. I struggle to my feet, thirsty and tired, and trying to process the last 4 hours of my life, but I don't have the mental bandwidth at the moment. I trek out of the baseball field into a working-class South Side neighborhood. The streets are empty. It's block after block of peaceful, quiet homes. I walk a mile, maybe more, and then I'm standing at the empty intersection of a business district, watching the traffic lights above me cycle at an accelerated late-night pace. The main drag runs 2 blocks, and there's no sign of life except the shithole bar across the street with 3 mass-produced beer signs glowing in the windows. As patrons stagger out in a cloud of smoke and overloud conversations, headlights from the first car I've seen in 20 minutes appear in the distance, a cab with the off-duty light illuminated. I step out into the intersection and stand under the traffic light, waving my arms. The taxi slows down on approach and tries to swerve around me, but I sidestep, keeping its bumper on a collision course, forcing it to stop. The driver lowers his window, angry.
What the hell are you doing?
I need a ride. The cabbie is Somali, his razor-thin face splotched with patches of a beard, and he's staring at me through a pair of giant, thick-lensed glasses. He says,
It's 2 a.m. I'm done tonight. No more work.
Please.
Can you read? Look at the sign.
He slaps the top of his car. I need to get home. The window begins to rise. I reach into my pocket and pull out the plastic bag containing my personal effects, rip it open, show him the money clip.
I can pay you more than... Get out of the road!
I'll double your rate. The window stops 6 inches from the top of the door.
Cash!
Cash. I thumb quickly through the wad of bills. It's probably a $75 fare to the Northside neighborhoods, and I've got to cover double that.
Get in if we go, he yells.
Some of the bar patrons have noticed the cab stopped in the intersection, and presumably needing rides, they are drifting over, shouting for me to hold the car. I finish counting my funds, $332 and 3 expired credit cards. I climb into the back seat and tell him I'm going to Logan Square.
That's 25 miles,
and I'm paying you double. He glares at me in the rearview mirror.
Where's the money?
I peel off $100 and hand it into the front seat. The rest when we get there. He snatches the money and accelerates through the intersection, past the drunks. I examine the money clip. Under the cash and the credit cards, there's an Illinois driver's license with a headshot that's me, but that I've never seen. An ID for a gym I've never been to. And a health insurance card from a carrier I've never used. The cabbie sneaks glances at me in the rearview mirror.
You have bad night, he says.
Looks that way, huh?
I thought you are drunk, but no. Your clothes are torn, face bloody.
I probably wouldn't have wanted to pick me up either, standing in the middle of an intersection at 2 a.m, looking homeless and deranged.
You're in trouble, he says.
Yeah.
What happened?
I'm not exactly sure.
I take you to hospital.
No, I want to go home.
3. We cruise north toward the city on the vacant interstate, the skyline creeping closer and closer. With each passing mile, I feel some semblance of my sanity returning, if for no other reason than I'll be home soon. Daniela will help me make sense of whatever's happening. The cabbie parks across from my brownstone, and I pay him the rest of his fare. I hurry across the street and up the steps, pulling keys out of my pocket that aren't my keys. As I try to find the one that fits the lock, I realize this isn't my door. Well, it is my door. It's my street. My number on the mailbox. But the handle isn't right. The wood is too elegant. And the hinges are these iron, gothic-looking things more suited to a medieval tavern. I turn the deadbolt. The door swings inward. Something is wrong. Very, very wrong. I step across the threshold into the dining room. This doesn't smell like my house. Doesn't smell like anything but the faintest odor of dust. Like no one has lived here in quite some time. The lights are out, and not just some of them. Every last one. I close the door and fumble in the darkness until my hand grazes a dimmer switch. A chandelier made of antlers warms the room above a minimalist glass table that isn't mine and chairs that aren't mine. I call out,
Hello?
The house is so quiet, revoltingly quiet. In my home on the mantel behind the dining room table, there's a large candid photograph of Daniela, Charlie, and me standing at Inspiration Point in Yellowstone National Park. In this house, there's a deep contrast black-and-white photograph of the same canyon. More artfully done, but with no one in it. I move on to the kitchen, and at my entrance, a sensor triggers the recessed lighting. It's gorgeous, expensive, and lifeless. In my house, there's a Charlie first-grade creation, macaroni art, held by magnets to our white refrigerator. It makes me smile every time I see it. In this kitchen, there's not even a blemish on the steel facade of the Gaggenau refrigerator. Daniela! Even the resonance of my voice is different here. Charlie! There's less stuff, more echo. As I walk through the living room, I spot my old turntable sitting next to a state-of-the-art sound system, my library of jazz vinyl lovingly stowed and alphabetized on custom built-in shelves. I head up the stairs to the second floor. The hallway is dark, and the light switch isn't where it should be, but it doesn't matter. Much of the lighting system runs on motion sensors, and more recessed bulbs wink on above me. This isn't my hardwood floor. It's nicer, the planks wider, a little rougher. Between the hall bath and the guest room, the triptych of my family at the Wisconsin Dells has been replaced with a sketch of Navy Pier, charcoal on butcher paper. The artist's signature in the bottom right-hand corner catches my eye. Daniela Vargas. I step into the next room on the left, my son's room. Except it's not. There's none of his surrealist artwork. No bed, no manga posters, no desk with homework strewn across it, no lava lamps, no backpack, no clothes scattered all over the floor. Instead, just a monitor sitting on an expansive desk that's covered in books and loose paper. I walk in shock to the end of the hallway. Sliding a frosted pocket door into the wall, I enter a master bedroom that is luxurious, cold, and, like everything else in this brownstone, not mine. The walls are adorned with more charcoal butcher paper sketches in the style of the one in the hall. But the centerpiece of the room is a glass display case built into an acacia wood stand. Light from the base shines up dramatically to illuminate a certificate in a padded leather folder that leans against a plush velvet pillar. Hanging from a thin chain on the pillar is a gold coin with Julian Pavia's likeness imprinted in the metal. The certificate reads, "The Pavia Prize is awarded to Jason Ashley Dessen for outstanding achievement in advancing our knowledge and understanding of the origin, evolution, and properties of the universe by placing a macroscopic object into a state of quantum superposition." I sit on the end of the bed. I am not well. I am so not well. My home should be my haven, a place of safety and comfort, where I'm surrounded by family. But it's not even mine. My stomach lurches. I rush into the master bath, fling open the toilet seat, and empty my guts into the pristine bowl. I'm racked with thirst. I turn on the faucet and dip my mouth under the stream, splash water in my face. I wander back into the bedroom. No idea where my mobile phone is, but there's a landline on the bedside table. I never actually dial Daniela's cell phone number, so it takes me a moment to recall, but I finally punch it in. Four rings. A male voice answers, deep and groggy.
"Hello?"
"Where's Daniela?"
"I think you misdialed."
I recite Daniela's cell phone number, and he says,
"Yeah, that's the number you called, but it's my number."
"How is that possible?" He hangs up. I dial her number again, and this time he answers on the first ring with, "It's 3 a.m. Don't call me again, asshole." My third attempt goes straight to the man's voicemail. I don't leave a message. Rising from the bed, I return to the bathroom and study myself in the mirror over the sink. My face is bruised, scraped, bloody and mud-streaked. I need a shave. My eyes are bloodshot. But I'm still me. A wave of exhaustion hits me like a haymaker to the jaw. My knees give out. but I catch myself on the countertop. And then, down on the first floor, a noise. A door closing softly. I straighten, alert again. Back in the bedroom, I move silently to the doorway and stare down the length of the hall. I hear whispered voices, the static of a handheld radio, the hollow creak of someone's footfall on a hardwood step. The voices become clearer, echoing between the walls of the stairwell and spilling out the top and down the corridor. I can see their shadows on the walls now, preceding them up the staircase like ghosts. As I take a tentative step into the hallway, a man's voice, calm, measured, laden, slides out of the stairwell. "Jason." 5 steps and I reach the hall bath. "We're not here to hurt you." Their footfalls are in the hallway now, stepping slowly, methodically. "I know you're feeling confused and disoriented. I wish you'd said something back at the lab. I didn't realize how bad it was for you. I'm sorry I missed that." I carefully close the door behind me and push in the lock. "We just want to bring you in so you don't hurt yourself or anyone else." The bathroom is twice the size of mine, with a granite-walled shower and a double vanity topped with marble. Across from the toilet, I see what I'm looking for. A large shelf built into the wall with a hatch that opens the laundry chute. "Jason!" Through the bathroom door, I hear the radio crackling. "Jason, please, talk to me." Out of nowhere, his voice hemorrhages frustration. "We have all given up our lives working toward tonight! Come out here! This is fucking insane!" One rainy Sunday, when Charlie was 9 or 10, we spent an afternoon pretending we were spelunkers. I would lower him down the laundry chute again and again, as if it were the entrance to a cave. He even wore a little backpack and a makeshift headlamp, a flashlight tied to the top of his head. I open the hatch, scramble up onto the shelf. Layton says, "Take the bedroom." Footsteps patter down the hall. The fit down the laundry chute looks tight, maybe too tight. I hear the bathroom door begin to shake, the doorknob jiggling, and then a woman's voice. "Hey, this one's locked!" I peer down the chute. Total darkness. The bathroom door is thick enough that their first attempt to break through only results in a splintering crack. I might not even fit down this thing, but as they crash into the door a second time and it explodes off the hinges and thunders down against the tile, I realize I have no other options. They rush into the bathroom, and in the mirror I catch the fleeting reflection of Leighton Vance and one of those security consultants from the lab holding what appears to be a taser. Leighton and I lock eyes in the glass for half a second, and then the man with the taser spins, raising his weapon. I fold my arms into my chest and commit myself to the chute. As the shouting in the bathroom fades away above me, I slam into an empty laundry hamper, the plastic splitting, sending me tumbling out from between the washer and the dryer. Their footsteps are already coming, pounding down the staircase. A needle of pain threads up my right leg from the fall. I scramble to my feet and bolt for the French doors that lead out the back of the brownstone. The brass door handles are locked. Footsteps are closing in, the voices louder. Radios squeaking as instructions scream over static. I turn the lock, pull open the doors, and tear across a redwood deck which boasts a grill that's nicer than mine and a hot tub I have never owned. Down the steps into the backyard past a rose garden, I try the garage door, but it's locked. With all the movement inside, every light in the house has been triggered. There must be 4 or 5 people running around on the first floor trying to find me, shouting at one another. An 8-foot privacy fence encloses the backyard, and as I flip the hasp on its door, someone barrels onto the deck, shouting my name. The alley is empty, and I don't stop to think which direction to go. I just run. At the next street, I glance back, see 2 figures chasing me. In the distance, a car engine roars to life, followed by the screech of tires spinning on pavement. I hang a left and sprint until I reach the next alley. Almost every backyard is protected by tall privacy fencing, but the fifth one down is waist-high, wrought iron construction. An SUV whips its back end around and accelerates into the alley. I brake for the low fence. Lacking the strength to hurdle it, I clumsily haul myself over the pointed metal tines and collapse in the backyard. I crawl through the grass to a tiny shed beside the garage with no padlock on the door. It creaks open, and I slip inside as someone runs across the backyard. I shut the door so no one will hear my panting. I cannot catch my breath. It's pitch black inside the shed and redolent of gasoline and old grass clippings. My chest heaves against the back of the door. Sweat drips off my chin. I claw a cobweb off my face. In darkness, my hands palm the plywood walls, fingers grazing various tools, pruning shears, a saw, a rake, the blade of an axe. I take the axe from the wall and grip the wooden handle, scraping my finger across the head. Can't see a thing, but it feels like it hasn't been sharpened in years. Deep chinks in the blade, which no longer holds an edge. Blinking through the stinging sweat, I carefully open the door. Not a sound creeps in. I nudge it open a few more inches until I can see into the backyard again. It's empty. In this sliver of quiet and calm, the principle of Occam's razor whispers to me. All things being equal, the simplest solution tends to be the right one. Does the idea that I was drugged and kidnapped by a secret experimental group for the purposes of mind control or God knows what fit that bill? Hardly. They would have needed to either brainwash me to convince me that my house was not my house, or in the space of several hours, get rid of my family and gut the interior so I didn't recognize anything. Or is it more plausible that a tumor in my brain has turned my world upside down? That it's been growing silently inside my skull for months or years and is finally wreaking havoc on my cognitive processes, skewing my perception of everything? The idea hits me with the force of conviction. What else could have crashed through me with such debilitating speed? What else could make me lose touch with my identity and reality in a matter of hours, calling into question everything I thought I knew? I wait and wait and wait. Finally, I step outside into the grass. No more voices, no more footsteps. No shadows, no car engines. The night feels sturdy and real again. I already know where I'm headed next. Chicago Mercy is a 10-block trek from my house, and I limp into the harsh light of the ER at 4:05 a.m. I hate hospitals. I watched my mother die in one. Charlie spent the first weeks of his life in an NICU. The waiting room is practically empty. Aside from me, there's a night construction worker clutching his arm in a bloody bandage, and a distressed-looking family of three, the father holding a red-faced, wailing baby. The woman at the front desk looks up from her paperwork, surprisingly bright-eyed considering the hour. Asks through the plexiglass, "How can I help you?" I haven't thought of what to say, how to even begin to explain my needs. When I don't answer right away, she says, "Have you been in an accident?" "No." "You have cuts all over your face." "I'm not well," I say. "What do you mean?" "I think I need to talk to someone."
"Are you homeless?"
"No."
"Where's your family?"
"I don't know." She looks me up and down, a fast, professional appraisal.
"Your name, sir?"
"Jason."
"One moment."
Rising from her chair, she disappears around the corner. 30 seconds later, there's a buzzing sound as the door beside her station unlocks and opens. The nurse smiles.
"Come on back."
She leads me to a patient room.
"Someone will be right with you."
As the door closes after her, I take a seat on the examination table and shut my eyes against the glare of the lights. I have never been so tired in my life. My chin dips. I straighten. I almost fell asleep sitting up. The door opens. A portly young doctor walks in carrying a clipboard. He's trailed by a different nurse, a bottle blonde in blue scrubs, who wears 4 in the morning exhaustion like a millstone around her neck. "It's Jason?" the doctor asks, without offering his hand or attempting to fake his way through the graveyard shift indifference. I nod. "Last name?" I'm hesitant to give him my full name, but then again, maybe that's just the brain tumor talking, or whatever has gone wrong inside my head. Dessen. I spell it for him as he scribbles on what I presume to be an intake form. I'm Dr. Randolph, attending physician. What brings you into the ER tonight? I think something is wrong with my mind, like a tumor or something.
What makes you say that?
Things aren't like they should be.
Okay, could you elaborate?
All right, this is going to sound crazy. Just know that I realize that. He glances up from the clipboard. My house isn't my house.
I'm not following.
It's just what I said. My house isn't my house. My family isn't there. Everything's much nicer. It's all been renovated and...
But it's still your address?
Right.
So you're saying the inside is different, but the outside is the same.
He says it like he's speaking to a child.
Yeah. Jason, how did you get the cuts on your face, the mud on your clothes?
People were chasing me. I shouldn't have told him that, but I'm too tired to filter. I must sound absolutely insane.
Chasing you?
Yes.
Who was chasing you?
I don't know.
Do you know why they were chasing you?
Because it's complicated. His appraising, skeptical look is far more subtle and trained than the front desk nurse's. I almost miss it.
Have you taken any drugs or alcohol tonight?
He asks. Some wine earlier than whiskey, but that was hours ago.
Again, I'm sorry. It's been a very long shift. But what makes you think something is wrong with your mind?
Because the last 8 hours of my life don't make sense. It all feels real, but it can't possibly be.
Have you suffered a recent head injury?
No. Well, I mean, I think someone hit me in the back of the head. It's painful to the touch.
Who hit you?
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure of anything right now.
Okay. Do you use drugs now or in the past?
I smoke weed a couple times a year, but not lately. The doctor turns to the nurse.
I'm going to have Barbara draw some blood.
He drops the clipboard on a table and plucks a penlight from the front pocket of his lab coat.
Mind if I examine you?
No. Randolph moves in until our faces are inches apart, close enough for me to smell the stale coffee on his breath, to see the recent razor nick across his chin. He shines the light straight into my right eye. For a moment, there's nothing but a point of brilliance in the center of my field of vision, which momentarily burns away the rest of the world.
Jason, are you having any thoughts of hurting yourself?
I'm not suicidal. The light hits my left eye.
Have you had any prior psychiatric hospitalizations?
No. He gently takes my wrist in his soft, cool hands, measures my pulse rate.
What do you do for a living? He asks.
I teach at Lakemont College.
Married?
Yes. I instinctively reach down to touch my wedding band. Gone.
Jesus.
The nurse begins to roll up the left sleeve of my shirt.
What's your wife's name? The doctor asks.
Daniela.
You two on good terms?
Yes.
Don't you think she's wondering where you are? I feel like we should call her.
I tried.
When?
An hour ago, at my house. Someone else answered. It was a wrong number.
Maybe you misdialed.
I know my wife's phone number. The nurse asks,
"We okay with needles, Mr. Dessen?"
Yes. As she sterilizes the underside of my arm, she says,
"Dr. Randolph, look."
She touches the needle mark from several hours ago when Layton drew my blood.
"When did this happen?"
he asks. "I don't know."
Probably best not to mention the lab I think I just escaped from. You don't remember someone sticking a needle in your arm?
No.
Randolph nods to the nurse, and she warns me.
Little pinch coming.
He asks, do you have your cell phone with you?
I don't know where it is.
He grabs the clipboard. Give me your wife's name again and phone number. We'll try to reach her for you. I spell Daniela's name and rattle off her cell number and our home number as my blood rushes into a plastic vial.
You're going to scan my head, I ask, see what's going on?
Absolutely.
They give me a private room on the 8th floor. I tidy up my face in the bathroom, kick off my shoes, and climb into bed. Sleep tugs, but the scientist in my brain won't power down. I can't stop thinking, formulating hypotheses and dismantling them, struggling to wrap logic around everything that's happened. In this moment, I have no way of knowing what's real and what isn't. I can't even be sure that I was ever married. No, wait. I raise my left hand and study my ring finger. The ring is gone, but the proof of its existence lingers as a faint indentation around the base of my finger. It was there. It left a mark. That means someone took it. I touch the indentation, acknowledging both the horror and the comfort of what it represents. The last vestige of my reality. I wonder, what will happen when this last physical trace of my marriage is gone? When there's no anchor? As the skies above Chicago inch toward dawn, a hopeless, cloud-ridden purple, I lose myself to sleep.
4.
Daniela's hands are deep in the warm, soapy water when she hears the front door slam shut.
She stops scrubbing the saucepan she's been attacking for the last half minute and looks up from the sink, glancing back over her shoulder as footsteps approach.
Jason appears in the archway between the kitchen and the dining room, grinning, as her mother would say, like a fool.
Turning her attention back to the dishes, Daniela says, "There's a plate for you in the fridge." In the steamed reflection of the window above the sink, she watches her husband set the canvas grocery bag on the island and move toward her. His arms slide around her waist. She says, half-jokingly, "If you think a couple pints of ice cream are going to get you out of this, I don't know what to tell you." He presses up against her and whispers in her ear, his breath fiery with the remnants of whatever whiskey he's been drinking. "Life's short. Don't be mad. It's a waste of time."
How did 45 minutes turn into almost 3 hours?
The same way one drink turns into two, which turns into three, and on it goes. I feel terrible. His lips on the back of her neck put a delicate shiver down her spine. She says, "You're not getting out of this." Now he kisses the side of her neck. It's been a while since he touched her like this. His hands glide into the water. He interlaces their fingers.
"You should eat something," she says. "I'll warm up your plate."
She tries to step past him on her way to the fridge, but he blocks her path. Facing him now, she stares up into his eyes, and maybe it's because they've both been drinking, but there's an intensity in the air between them, as if every molecule has been charged. He says, "My God, I've missed you."
"Exactly how much did you drink to—"
He kisses her out of nowhere, backing her up against the cabinets, the counter digging into her back as he runs his hands over her hips and pulls her shirt out of her jeans, his hands on her skin now, as hot as an oven range. She pushes him back toward the island.
"Jesus, Jason."
Now she studies him in the low light of the kitchen, trying to figure out this energy he swaggered back into their home with.
"Something happened while you were out," she says.
"Nothing happened, other than I lost track of time."
"So you didn't chat up some young thing at Ryan's party who made you feel 25 again, and now you're back here with a hard-on
pretending, he laughs beautifully.
What?
She says. That's what you think is going on here? He takes a step toward her. When I left the bar, my mind was elsewhere. I wasn't thinking. I stepped out into traffic, and this cab nearly splattered me all over the pavement, scared the hell out of me. I don't know how to explain it, but ever since that moment, in the grocery store, walking home, standing here in our kitchen, I have felt so alive. Like I see my life with force and clarity for once. All the things I have to be grateful for. You, Charlie. She feels her anger toward him beginning to melt. He says, it's like we get so set in our ways, so entrenched in those grooves, we stop seeing our loved ones for who they are. But tonight, right now, I see you again, like the first time we met, when the sound of your voice and your smell was this new country. I'm rambling now. Daniela goes to him and cups his face in her hands and kisses him. Then she takes his hand and leads him upstairs. The hallway is dark, and she can't think of the last time her husband did something to make her heart pound like this. At Charlie's room, she stops for a moment and leans her ear against the closed door, logs the muffled noise of music blaring through headphones.
All clear,
she whispers. They move down the creaky hallway as softly as they can. In their bedroom, Daniela locks the door and opens the top drawer of her dresser, searching for a candle to light. But Jason has no time for it. He pulls her over to the bed and drags her down onto the mattress, and then he's on top of her, kissing her, his hands moving under her clothes, roaming her body. She feels wetness on her cheek, her lips, tears. His. Holding his face between her hands, she asks,
why are you crying?
I felt like I'd lost you.
You have me, Jason,
she says.
I'm right here, baby. You have me.
As he undresses her in the darkness of their bedroom, she has never wanted anyone so desperately. The anger is gone. The wine sleepiness has vanished. He has taken her back to the first time they made love, in her Bucktown loft, with the downtown glowing through the giant windows that she cracked open so the crisp October air could trickle in, carrying with it the late-night noise of people stumbling home from bars and distant sirens and the engine of the massive city at rest. Not completely shut down, never off, just a comforting, baseline idle. As she comes, she fights not to cry out in their bedroom, but she can't contain it, and neither can Jason. Not tonight. Because something is different. Something is better. They haven't been unhappy these last few years, quite the opposite. But it's been a long, long time since she felt that sense of giddy love that effervesces in the pit of your stomach and spectacularly upends the world. 5. Mr. Dessen? I jerk awake.
Hi, sorry to startle you.
A doctor is staring down at me, a short, green-eyed redhead in a white lab coat, holding a cup of coffee in one hand, a tablet in the other. I sit up. It's day outside the window next to my bed, and for 5 seconds, I have absolutely no idea where I am. Through the glass, low clouds blanket the city, cutting off the skyline above 1,000 feet. From this vantage point, I can see the lake and 2 miles of Chicago neighborhoods filling the space in between, everything muted under a somber Midwestern gray.
Mr. Dessen, do you know where you are?
Mercy Hospital.
That's right.
You walked into the ER last night, pretty disoriented. One of my colleagues, Dr. Randolph, admitted you, and when he left this morning, he handed your chart over to me. I'm Julianne Springer. I glance down at the IV in my wrist and trace the line up to the bag hanging over me on a metal stand. What are you giving me? I ask.
Just old-fashioned H2O. You were very dehydrated. How are you feeling now?
I run a quick self-diagnostic. Queasy, head pounding, inside of my mouth like cotton. I point through the window. "Like that," I say, weirdly hungover. Beyond the physical discomfort, I register a crushing sense of emptiness, like it's raining directly on my soul, like I've been hollowed out.
"I have your MRI results," she says, waking her tablet.
"Your scan came back normal. There was some shallow bruising, but nothing serious. Your tox screen results are far more illuminating. We found traces of alcohol, in line with what you reported to Dr. Randolph, but also something else."
"What?"
"Ketamine." "Not familiar with it."
"It's a surgical anesthetic. One of its side effects is short-term amnesia. Could explain some of your disorientation. The tox screen also showed something I've never seen before. A psychoactive compound. Really weird cocktail."
She sips her coffee.
"I have to ask, you didn't take these drugs yourself?"
"Of course not."
"Last night, you gave Dr. Randolph your wife's name and a couple of phone numbers. Her cell and our landline."
"I've been trying to track her down all morning, but her mobile number belongs to a guy named Ralph, and your landline just keeps going to voicemail."
"Can you read her number back to me?"
Springer reads off Daniela's cell phone number.
"That's right," I say.
"You're sure about that?"
100%.
As she looks back at the tablet, I ask, "Could these drugs you found in my system cause long-term altered states?"
"You mean delusions? Hallucinations?"
"Exactly.
To be honest, I don't know what this psychochemical is, which means I can't say with any certainty what effect it might have had on your nervous system."
"So it could still be affecting me?"
"Again, I don't know what its half-life is, or how long it takes your body to expel it. But you don't strike me as being under the influence of anything at the moment."
Memories of the night before are regenerating. I see myself walking naked and at gunpoint into an abandoned building, the injection in my neck, in my leg. Pieces of a strange conversation with a man wearing a geisha mask. A room filled with old generators and moonlight. And while the thought of last night carries the emotional weight of a real memory, it has the fantasy lining of a dream or a nightmare. What was done to me inside that old building? Springer pulls a chair over and takes a seat beside my bed. In proximity, I can see freckles covering her face like a sprinkling of pale sand.
"Let's talk about what you said to Dr. Randolph. He wrote down..."
She sighs.
"Apologies, his handwriting is atrocious. Patient reports, 'It was my house, but it wasn't my house.' You also said that you got the cuts and bruises on your face because people were chasing you. But when asked why they were chasing you, you couldn't provide an answer."
She looks up from the screen.
"You're a professor?"
"Correct."
"At?"
"Lakemont College."
"Here's the thing, Jason. While you were sleeping, and after we couldn't find any trace of your wife..."
"What do you mean you couldn't find any trace of her?"
"Her name is Daniela Dessen, correct?"
"Yes."
39 years old?"
"Yeah."
"We couldn't find anyone with that name and age in all of Chicago."
That levels me. I look away from Springer, back out the window. It's so gray that even the time of day is masked. Morning, noon, evening, it's impossible to determine. Fine droplets of rain cling to the other side of the glass. At this point, I'm not even sure what to be afraid of. This reality that might actually be true, or the possibility that everything is going to pieces inside my head. I liked it much better when I thought everything was being caused by a brain tumor. That, at least, was an explanation.
"Jason, we took the liberty of looking you up. Your name, profession, everything we could find. I want you to answer me very carefully. Do you really believe you're a physics professor at Lakemont College?"
"I don't believe it. It's what I am."
"We trolled the faculty web pages for science departments in every university and college in Chicago, including Lakemont. You weren't listed as a professor on any of them."
"That's impossible. I've been teaching there since..."
"Let me finish.
because we did find some information about you. She typed something on her tablet. Jason Ashley Dessen, born 1973 in Denison, Iowa, to Randall and Ellie Dessen. Says here that your mother passed when you were 8. How, if you don't mind my asking? She had an underlying heart condition, caught a bad strain of the flu, which turned into pneumonia.
Sorry to hear that.
She continues reading. Bachelor's degree from University of Chicago, 1995. PhD from same university, 2002. So far, so good? I nod. Awarded the Pavia Prize in 2004, and the same year, Science Magazine honored your work with a cover story, calling it the breakthrough of the year. Guest lecturer at Harvard, Princeton, UC Berkeley. She looks up, meets my bewildered gaze, and then turns the tablet around so I can see that she's reading from the Wikipedia page of Jason A. Dessen. My sinus rhythm on the heart monitor I'm attached to has become noticeably faster. Springer says, "You haven't published any new papers or accepted any teaching positions since 2005, when you took on the role of chief science officer with Velocity Laboratories, a jet propulsion lab. It says finally that a missing persons report was filed on your behalf 8 months ago by your brother, and that you haven't been seen publicly in over a year." This rocks me so deeply I can barely draw a breath. My blood pressure triggers some kind of alarm on the heart monitor, which begins to emit a grating beep. A heavyset nurse appears in the doorway.
"We're fine," Springer says. "Could you shut that thing up?"
The nurse walks to the monitor, silences the alarm. When he's gone, the doctor reaches over the railing and touches my hand.
"I want to help you, Jason. I can see that you're terrified. I don't know what's happened to you, and I get the feeling you don't either."
The wind coming in off the lake is strong enough to blow the rain sideways. I watch as the droplets streak across the glass and blur the world beyond into an impressionistic cityscape of gray, punctuated by the glow of distant taillights, distant headlights. Springer says, "I've called the police. They're sending a detective over to take a statement from you and begin trying to get to the bottom of what happened last night. That's the first thing we're doing. Now, I've struck out trying to get in touch with Daniela, but I have been able to locate contact information for your brother, Michael, in Iowa City. I'd like to have your permission to call him and let him know that you're here and to discuss your condition with him." I don't know what to say to that. I haven't spoken to my brother in 2 years. "I'm not sure if I want you to call him," I say.
"Fair enough, but to be clear, under HIPAA,
if in my judgment a patient of mine is unable to agree or object to a disclosure due to incapacity or emergency circumstances, I am authorized to decide whether disclosing your information to a family member or friend is in your best interest. I do believe that your current mental state qualifies as incapacity, and I think consulting with someone who knows you and your history is in your best interest. So I will be calling Michael." She glances down at the floor, as if she doesn't want to tell me whatever's coming next. "Third thing, last thing," she says. "We need the guidance of a psychiatrist to get a handle on your condition. I'm having you transferred over to Chicago Reed, which is a mental health center a little further up on the north side." Look, I admit that I don't have a firm grasp on exactly what's happening, but I'm not crazy. I'd be happy to talk to a psychiatrist. In fact, I'd welcome the opportunity, but I'm not volunteering to be committed if that's what you're asking.
"It's not what I'm asking.
With all due respect, Jason, you don't have a choice in the matter."
"Excuse me?"
"It's called an M1 hold, and by law, if I think you're a threat to yourself or others, I can order a 72-hour involuntary commitment. Look, this is the best thing for you. You're in no condition."
I walked into this hospital under my own steam because I wanted to find out what was wrong with me.
"And that was the right choice, and that's exactly what we're going to do. Find out why you're having this break with reality and set you up with the treatment you need to make a full recovery." I watch my blood pressure rising on the monitor. I don't want to set off the alarm again. Closing my eyes, I breathe in. Let it out. Take another shot of oxygen. My levels recede. I say, so you're going to put me in a rubber room, no belt, no sharp objects, and medicate me into a stupor?
It's not like that. You came into this hospital because you wanted to get better, right? Well, this is the first step. I need you to trust me.
Springer rises from the chair and drags it back across the room under the television.
Just keep resting, Jason. Police will be here soon, and then we'll get you moved over to Chicago Reed this evening.
I watch her go, the threat of unraveling right on top of me, pressing down. What if all the pieces of belief and memory that comprise who I am, my profession, Daniela, my son, are nothing but a tragic misfiring in that gray matter between my ears? Will I keep fighting to be the man I think I am, or will I disown him and everything he loves and step into the skin of the person this world would like for me to be? And if I have lost my mind, what then? What if everything I know is wrong? No, stop! I am not losing my mind. There were drugs in my blood from last night and bruises on my body. My key opened the door to that house that wasn't mine. I don't have a brain tumor. There's a mark from a wedding band on my ring finger. I am in this hospital room right now, and all of this is actually happening. I am not allowed to think I'm crazy. I am only allowed to solve this problem. When the elevator doors open to the hospital lobby, I shoulder past two men in cheap suits and wet overcoats. They look like cops, and as they step into the elevator car and our eyes meet, I wonder if they're heading up to see me. I move past a waiting area, toward the automatic doors. Since I wasn't on a secured ward, slipping out was much easier than I expected. I simply got dressed, waited for the hallway to clear, and cruised past the nurse's station without anyone so much as raising an eyebrow. As I approach the exit, I keep waiting for alarms to sound, for someone to shout my name, for guards to chase me through the lobby. Soon, I'm outside in the rain, and it feels like early evening, the bustle of traffic supporting something in the neighborhood of 6 p.m. I hurry down the steps, hit the sidewalk, and don't slow my pace until I've reached the next block. I glance over my shoulder. There's no one following me, at least as far as I can tell. Just a sea of umbrellas. I'm getting wet. I have no idea where I'm going. At a bank, I step off the sidewalk and take shelter under the entrance overhang. Leaning against a limestone column, I watch people move past as rain drills down on the pavement. I dig my money clip out of my slacks. Last night's cab fare made a sizable dent in my measly treasury. I'm down to $182, and my credit cards are worthless. Home is out of the question, but there's a cheap hotel in my neighborhood a few blocks from my brownstone, and it's just gross enough to make me think I could possibly afford a room there. I step back out into the rain. It's getting darker by the minute. Colder. Without a coat or jacket, I'm soaked to my skin within two blocks. The Days Inn occupies the building across the street from Village Tap. Only it doesn't. The canopy is the wrong color, and the entire facade looks bizarrely upmarket. These are luxury apartments. I even see a doorman standing on the curb under an umbrella, trying to hail a cab for a woman in a black trench coat. Am I on the right street? I cast a glance back to my corner bar. Village Tap should be blinking neon in the front window, but instead, there's a heavy wooden panel with brass lettering attached to a pole that's swinging over the entrance, creaking in the wind. I continue walking, faster now, the rain driving into my eyes, past rowdy taverns, restaurants poised to receive the dinner rush, sparkling wine glasses and silverware quickly arranged on white linen tablecloths as servers memorize the specials. A coffee shop I don't recognize, bursting with the jangle of an espresso machine grinding fresh beans. Danielle is in my favorite Italian place, looking exactly as it should, and reminding me that I haven't eaten in almost 24 hours. But I keep walking, until I'm wet through to my socks, until I'm shivering uncontrollably, until night has dropped and I'm standing outside a three-story hotel with bars on the windows and an obnoxiously large sign above the entrance. Hotel Royale. I step inside, dripping a puddle on the cracked checkerboard floor. It isn't what I expected. Not seedy or dirty in the lurid sense of the word. Just forgotten. Past prime. The way I remember my great-grandparents' living room in their teetering Iowa farmhouse. As if the worn furniture has been here for 1,000 years, frozen in time while the rest of the world marched on. The air carries the scent of must, and big band music plays quietly through a hidden sound system, something from the 1940s. At the front desk, the old tuxedoed clerk doesn't bat an eye at my sodden state, just takes $95 in damp cash and hands me a key to a room on the third floor. The elevator car is cramped, and I stare at my distorted features in the bronze doors as the car labors, noisily and with all the grace of a fat man climbing stairs, to the third floor. Halfway down a dim corridor, scarcely wide enough for two people to walk abreast, I locate my room number and wrestle the old school lock open with the key. It isn't much. A single bed with a flimsy metal frame and a lumpy mattress, a bathroom the size of a closet, a dresser, a cathode ray television, and a chair next to a window where something glows on the other side of the glass. Stepping around the foot of the bed, I sweep the curtain back and peer outside, finding myself at eye level with the top of the hotel sign and close enough to see the rain falling through the green neon light. Down on the sidewalk below, I glimpse a man leaning against a street lamp post, smoke curling up into the rain, the ash of a cigarette glowing and fading in the darkness under his hat. Is he waiting there for me? Maybe I'm being paranoid, but I go to the door and check the deadbolt and hook the chain. Then I kick off my shoes, strip down, and dry myself off with the bathroom's only towel. The best thing about the room is the ancient cast-iron radiator that stands under the window. I crank it up to high and hold my hands in the jetties of heat. I drape my wet clothes across the back of the chair and push it close to the radiator. In the bedside table drawer, I find a Gideon Bible and a sprawling Chicago Metro phone book. Stretching out across the creaky bed, I thumb to the D's and begin searching for my last name. I quickly locate my listing. Jason A. Dessen. Correct address. Correct number. I lift the phone receiver off the bedside table and call my landline. It rings 4 times, and then I hear my voice. Hi, you've reached Jason. Well, except not really, because I'm not actually here to take your call. This is a recording. You know what to do. I hang up before the beep. That isn't our home voicemail message. I feel insanity stalking me again, threatening to curl me up fetal and shatter me into a million pieces. But I shut it down, returning to my new mantra. I am not allowed to think I'm crazy. I am only allowed to solve this problem. Experimental physics, hell, all of science, is about solving problems. However, you can't solve them all at once. There's always a larger, overarching question, the big target. But if you obsess on the sheer enormity of it, you lose focus. The key is to start small. Focus on solving problems you can answer. Build some dry ground to stand on. And after you've put in the work, and if you're lucky, the mystery of the overarching question becomes knowable, like stepping slowly back from a photo montage to witness the ultimate image revealing itself. I have to separate myself from the fear, the paranoia, the terror, and simply attack this problem as if I were in a lab, one small question at a time. Build some dry ground to stand on. The overarching question that plagues me in this moment, what has happened to me? There's no way to answer that. Not yet. I have vague suspicions, of course, but suspicion leads to bias, and bias doesn't lead to truth. Why weren't Daniela and Charlie at our house last night? Why did it seem as though I live alone? No, that's still too big, too complex, narrow the field of data. Where are Daniela and Charlie? Better, but reduce it further. Daniela will know where my son is, so this is where I'll start. Where is Daniela? The sketches I saw last night on the walls of the house, that isn't my house, they were created by Daniela Vargas. She had signed them using her maiden name. Why? I hold my ring finger up to the neon light coming in through the window. The mark of my wedding band is gone. Was it ever there? I tear off a piece of loose thread from the curtain and tie it around my ring finger as a physical link to the world and the life I know. Then I return to the phone book and thumb through to the V's, stopping at the only entry for Daniela Vargas. I rip out the entire page and dial her number. The familiarity of her voice on the recording moves me, even while the message itself leaves me deeply unsettled. You've reached Daniela. I'm away painting. Leave a message. Ciao. Within an hour, my clothes are warm and nearly dry. I wash up, get dressed, and take the stairwell down to the lobby. Out on the street, the wind is blowing, but the rain has relented. The smoking man by the street lamp is gone. I'm lightheaded with hunger. I pass a half dozen restaurants before I find one that won't clean out my funds. A bright, grimy pizza joint that sells enormous deep dish slices. There's nowhere to sit inside, so I stand on the sidewalk, stuffing my face and wondering if this pizza is as life-changing as I think it is, or if I'm too ravenous to be discerning. Daniela's address is in Bucktown. I'm down to $75 in change, so I could hail a cab, but I feel like walking. The pedestrian and traffic levels point toward Friday night, and the air carries a commensurate energy. I head east to find my wife. Daniela's building is yellow brick with a facade covered in climbing ivy that's turning russet with the recent cold. The buzzer system is an old-fashioned brass panel, and I find her maiden name second up from the bottom of the first column. I press the buzzer 3 times, but she doesn't answer. Through the tall window panes that frame the door, I see a woman in an evening gown and overcoat, her stilettos clicking down the hallway as she approaches. I retreat from the window and turn away as the door swings open. She's on a cell, and by the whiff of alcohol attendant with her passing, I get the feeling she already has an enthusiastic head start on the evening. She doesn't notice me as she charges down the steps. I catch the edge of the door before it closes and take the stairwell to the 4th floor. Daniela's door is at the end of the hall. I knock and wait. No answer. I head back down to the lobby, wondering if I should just wait here for her to return. But what if she's out of town? What would she think if she came back to her apartment to find me loitering outside her building like some stalker? As I approach the main entrance, my eyes pass over a bulletin board covered in flyers announcing everything from gallery openings to book readings and poetry slams. The largest notice, taped to the center of the board, catches my attention. It's a poster, actually, advertising a show by Daniela Vargas at a gallery called Oomph. I stop, scan for the opening date. Friday, October 2nd. Tonight.